like, I knew from the minute Akhil said the idea to me, I was like, this is something I could actually jump into and work on for decades.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, we got a world first. We've got an entrepreneur revealing his company for the very first time right here in the pod. His name is Will O'Brien, and his company, well, you're about to find out. Here's my chat with Will.
Digitalization. What exactly is it and how can it transform your business? Well, the local enterprise office have you covered. Digitalization is incorporating digital tools into your business to improve efficiency and productivity, saving you time, money, and energy. It could be anything from stock control to an online payments or booking system. And now there's a grant for it all. The Grow Digital Voucher helps businesses go digital and pay for those improvements that will make a big difference to the way your business operates. And the best thing about it all, the local enterprise office can handle it all for you. Any business from any sector with up to 50 employees can apply for the Digital for Business audit. And from there, they will give you a bespoke digital roadmap for your business. Once that's sorted, you can apply for the Grow Digital Voucher to help pay for those changes. Simple as that. So, if you want to make those first digital steps with your business to help save you time, money, and energy, talk to your local enterprise office today or go to localenterpriseoffice.ie/digital to find out more or click the link in the description below. Now, on with today's episode. Will, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me.
Very formal.
Now, looking forward to having a chat.
So am I, man. I'm really looking forward to this. I normally say, right, oh, tell me a little bit about yourself and your company, but you have a stealth startup. So I'm going to ask you two questions, one to answer now, one to answer following. Why did you start a stealth startup? And then you're going to give us a world exclusive. I'm going to hype this up for people now, right? You're going to give us a world exclusive and reveal your new company right here in the pod. Mm-hmm. So why did you start a stealth startup?
Well, you don't need to be public from day one, I don't think. What we were doing required a lot of engineering problems to be solved before you know, we were getting serious about go-to-market. So, yeah, we didn't need to be public from day one. We were also, you know, the only people in the world doing what we were doing. So it was like, didn't really need to go shouting about it. Didn't really want to go shouting around about it. We were happy to just, you know, we've been in stealth for about a year now. We were happy to, you know, work in kind of quiet about it. We weren't doing a massive amount of hiring. We've made like, you know, a few hires, but didn't, you know, we knew who they were. They were in our network. So generally just like, yeah, the benefits didn't outweigh the potential costs. And also we were just busy. Like, I mean, like I've been working on the like PR stuff like the last few weeks and I've just been like it's just like there's other stuff I would rather be doing. So it was like it was way more high value for my time to be working on finding partners, finding customers, rather than like writing like a press release or something like that, or like emailing, you know, whatever, you know, like. So we just didn't need to, and then we just got like really really busy, and then you're like about a year into it, we were like, oh, we should probably we should probably tell people what we're doing.
So it was a deliberate strategy.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, well, it wasn't that deliberate. It honestly was. We just got busy and we were like, oh, and then we were like, we actually don't need to announce what we're doing. We're like, we can work like this as long as we want. And yeah, we could probably keep going in stealth, but we were like, ah, let's make the announcement. Let's tell people what we're doing. So,
did anyone care that you were in stealth? Anyone you speak to bring it up?
No, it definitely like it maybe inhibited some customer conversations because you didn't have like a fancy website that had, you know, who your backers are or like who you've already partnered with and like your backgrounds. So that was perhaps like limiting, but I mean, we've had very good success in the last year on the commercial side. So, I mean, it hasn't been the limiting factor, but maybe things could have moved quicker or some people might have replied to emails if we had of, you know, had that. So, yeah, hard to tell, but I think it was the right one. I think like it just gave us focus as well, you know, like, and yeah, we were just doing the work. And, you know,
how refreshing. Startup founder actually does the work instead of getting caught up in all the hype and the buzz and just the distraction.
Yeah. None of us are too keen on that. So myself and three brilliant co-founders, and yeah, none of us were like, oh, let's do press release. But it's funny, it's because like my mum has been the only one approaching us, because she's like, I want to tell my friends what you're doing. Well, it looks, sounds great. And I was like, okay, mum, like, we'll have like a press release in a while, but
you're on an embargo, mum. Let me tell you what that means.
Yeah. So, yeah,
what does Will do now? Don't know.
Yeah.
Can't tell you. He's a spy.
Yeah. I wish. That would be cool. No.
So give us the big reveal. What are you working on, Will?
So the company, myself and three of my friends have founded, is called Ulysses Ecosystem Engineering. So we're building autonomous robots for ocean ecosystem restoration. We kind of stumbled upon this problem a year ago. One of my co-founders, Jamie, was on a surf trip with a buddy of his who was chatting to her, and she's a marine biologist. And basically, she was working a lot on ocean ecosystem restoration, particularly this one type of plant called seagrass. And she was just complaining about it. It was like super difficult, really, really expensive project. There had been a lot of death and loss of that ecosystem in that area, and they were making very slow progress at basically restoring it back to, you know, pre-industrial levels of seagrass in that area. And Jamie, he's a robotics engineer. He was like the first mechanical engineer in Mana. He thinks about these like very technically. He was asking her like, you know, what like automation is there, like is there any technology involved? And they're like, nah, like the main way we use to like restore seagrass is we take seeds and we broadcast them, i.e. throw them off the back of a boat.
Nice word, broadcast.
Yeah, the broadcast method. And that's like the leading status quo there. So then, you know, his kind of gears start turning aside. He's like, okay, there's not very much automation here. You know, like there's definitely stuff that can be done here, but like, you know, why would you even want to restore something like seagrass? Like what even is seagrass? So, and then, you know, when you go down that rabbit hole, it's an interesting one, because this plant like seagrass, it covers like less than 0.2% of our ocean floor, but it holds about 20% of the carbon in the ocean. And the ocean is the world's largest natural carbon sink. So this like one plant, it grows in every ocean on Earth, is carrying such a burden for society in removing carbon. And secondly, like also the wonders it does for biodiversity. So about 20% of the world's fish stocks rely on seagrass meadows. It's this great breeding ground for young fish, it's a place where other fish like to hide. So then you start realizing, okay, so there's this like incredible like ocean ecosystem that does like so much for the world, and like we are still kind of stuck in the stone ages with how we do restoration for it. What we resolved to do then was like, okay, like let's start building tools for this, and like let's like see if there's like, you know, a commercial model there. You know, there's a few avenues kind of commercially like how we can go about it, but essentially what we're trying to do is, in the same way that when, you know, society in the 20th century was faced with, you know, fears of maybe overpopulation, and, you know, there was this kind of like fear that like, you know, we have to stop growing our population, we have to like stop economic growth because our population is getting too big. And it was mainly oriented around food supply. We had the agricultural revolution, and we developed tools that radically increased the output of agriculture. And then, ergo, that population bomb that we all thought would happen didn't happen, and we were able to continue on this like path of growth. You know, we believe at Ulysses, like, we can do the same thing in the 21st century if we can develop, you know, in the way you had a green revolution in agriculture, you could do a blue revolution in ocean ecosystem restoration.
This is such a massive project, though. Like, how do you even? This is the bit that I'm always fascinated about when people tackle massive challenges. Where do you start? Bring me back to like day one, you and Jamie, and you're like, yeah.
Yeah, so then
here's the first step.
Jamie came back from the surf trip, and he got on to Akhil, one of my other co-founders who he had worked with in Mana, and was like, okay, think there's like a business here in, you know, building like, you know, automations for seagrass restoration. But, you know, seagrass restoration isn't like a massive market. So we were kind of still like, what's the move there? Then, you know, I start reading and then you're like, oh my God, this plant seagrass is 35 times better than rainforest or removing carbon. And you start like going to that, and then Akhil was kind of like, me and him went for a pint and we were like talking about this, and like, you know, there's something in this like immense carbon removal properties, and people had been doing like seagrass planting in different parts around the world, but they were doing it at like the hectare scale. And we like recognized, okay, if you can move like into like a new paradigm of restoration where you're not doing it on a hectare, you're doing it on like a square kilometer, then you can like really be removing serious amounts of carbon. And to kind of like put into context this kind of like, you know, why is removing carbon important? And, you know, what is the opportunity there? Well, the Paris Agreement says that we have to remove 10 billion tons of carbon per annum by 2050. We're doing on the order of about 100,000 tons of permanent carbon removal at the moment. So that means in, you know, roughly 25 years, we need to 100,000x increase the amount of carbon we're removing per annum. Or every like, you know, roughly like 13 months, we need to like double the size of this market. Or like, to give you like another like analogy, how big this is, it's like the concrete and cement industry does about 4 billion tons of industrial output every year. That is an industry that look, took about 200 years to develop and get off the ground. We've to create like an industry about twice the size of concrete and cement in 25 years to meet our Paris Agreement targets.
They seem just off the wall.
It's to insane.
To be honest, because I was reading up on them ahead of this chat. It just seems completely unrealistic. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm optimistic that, you know, people like you will solve it, but it just, you have to have big targets. Without big targets, you're not going to have big breakthroughs. But it just seems so big. Is it even possible?
Of course it is. Of course it is. Like, go back 100 years ago and when people were like inventing flight, like, thought that was impossible. What happened? We did it. You know? So like of course it's possible. Like, I mean, it's like technically feasible. It's taking, you know, an atom and putting it from one place to another. It's not like, it's doing it economically, right? And doing it in a way that doesn't, you know, inhibit like, the way we're living our lives at the moment. Like, yeah, definitely difficult, but it's not going to be just, you know, so we're taking the approach at Ulysses that, you know, we want to develop seagrass and other forms of aquatic plants as, you know, the way to draw down carbon, or one of the ways to draw down carbon. And, you know, we want to basically, you know, the ocean is already the world's largest natural carbon sink. We just want to use different methods like seagrass restoration to enhance that natural capability of removing carbon. And that, you know, that is going to be a $1 trillion industry by 2050. You know, you can't really say that about many things, but that's like what the numbers are saying at the moment. So there's a massive opportunity there, but it's not going to be just one solution. There's no silver bullet solution for anything in climate change. It's going to be like a myriad of, you know, small steps that get us there. You know, even in carbon removal, there's like going to be a full stack of options within carbon removal. You know, broadly, you can break it into two categories. You know, engineering technology-based solutions and nature-based solutions. And, you know, both have kind of pros and cons. Nature-based solutions are very easy to scale. But then, you know, the technology-based solutions perhaps could get cheaper in the long run because, you know, you can get kind of 10x, you know, improvements year on year and that sort of thing in the world of engineering. We're trying to do is kind of like position ourselves uniquely at the intersection of nature-based solutions and technology-based solutions. So what we did then, we basically were like, okay, there is a serious business model here.
What was the business model? Because that's the bit I love to see any entrepreneur start with the business model, because a lot of climate entrepreneurs, we spoke with this previously, climate entrepreneurs tend to be maybe more passionate than focused towards the business model. What was the business model you saw?
Yeah, so So we realized that, like, okay, there's definitely an opportunity in doing seagrass restoration better. And we realized that there's like a big business in just doing more seagrass restoration and doing it cheaper than existing commercial restoration providers. You know, many people in the market at the moment for commercial seagrass restoration are doing it for maybe like $1 million plus per hectare, you know, or hundreds of thousands of dollars per hectare. We can come in and, you know, vastly reduce that amount. So that's like, you know, a probably about $1 billion market that we can go into Ocean Ecosystem and just like provide better services with automation.
Who pays them?
Nonprofits and government. So for example, there's like whenever time there's like a big mega port or something like that being developed, you know, there's tens of millions being spent on ecosystem restoration to remediate the damage. Same at any coastal development that is done. Also, like last year, the European Union brought in a law called the Nature Restoration Law, which now mandates that that every government in the European Union hits nature restoration targets, you know, first by 2030 and then by 2050, but it's mandated, right? So all these kind of macros.
The best word in any business.
Yeah.
It's mandated.
Yeah, yeah. And then that's, you know, that's one business model for us doing restoration as a service. And then the other one is doing carbon removal. You know, restoring what we call seagrass gigameadows. So a restored seagrass meadow greater than 1 square kilometer, you know, which is like orders of magnitude greater than, you know, current restoration projects that are about hectares. And then, you know, generating carbon credits from that and selling them. So they're like the two core business models.
And when you say seagrass, this is class. This is just like, this is mind-blowing stuff. When you say seagrass, is it like, you know, 10 foot underwater or 100 meters underwater, or is it everywhere?
So it's important to note that the, like, you know, driving factor for seagrass is light. It's a photosynthetic plant, so it needs light. So the deeper you go, the less light there is. So it typically likes to be closer to the surface. It depends on the species. There's 72 species of seagrass. Some of them like deeper waters, colder waters. Some of them like to be even in intertidal areas. So we even have some of that in Dublin Bay. We've got Nultii, Zostera Nultii. There's actually some down kind of by the Balls Bridge area. You can go out and walk it when the tide's out. But then, like, you know, you go to Australia and there's like, some of the Posidonia species there can be found at, like, you know, 100 foot depths. So it depends on the species, how deep it likes to be, but generally closer to the surface, more light is good.
So next step, right? Three of you get together and you're like, right.
And we get another guy involved as well, our buddy Cullum. And then
let's start a seagrass business.
Well, we start building like a prototype. We're in my like living room.
And again, talk me to that, because you're like, okay, let's plant seagrass. What did you do? Did you do a lot of research to go, how the hell do you plant seagrass?
Oh, yeah.
Do you kind of go,
yes,
how do
yeah.
you get into the ocean floor or what?
Yeah, just like reading about it nonstop. I mean, we were all working jobs at the time, but like every spare hour we had was just reading about this plant. And it's mad. Like in a few weeks, you can go from knowing very, very little about seagrass to like knowing a lot. So we did that. And yeah, like... you know, my co-founders were, you know, developing CAD, you know, designing basically like what would one of these things look like. And yeah, we got like started 3D printing some parts, ordering stuff from Amazon, went down to the 40 foot, looking like complete maniacs with this like little robot critter we'd called Ariel, named after the Little Mermaid. And people were like, well, look, what the hell are these lads doing? And we were doing it in, testing it out, like using like sesame seeds as like, because basically, yeah, the seeds are, you've got like these small seagrass seeds, you're basically just trying to inject them into the sediment. That's, you know, that's how you plant seagrass. So, yeah, we were just like testing with like sesame seeds. And yeah, like first one like worked in ways, didn't work in others, you know, built another and kind of got confidence in what we were doing was serious, and started finding partners around the world that wanted to work with us and, you know, believed that, you know, we could solve problems for them. And
so you started off with a thesis of like, okay, we need to, you know, inject it into the ground, and then you just iterated to find the machine that would be able to inject them at scale into the ground.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, we had been reading the research on different like restoration methods. We opted for this one. And then the guys became confident that we had like an engineering direction that would get us up to, you know, doing the capability that, you know, one robot could do, you know, multiple hectares of restoration per day. And we started doing that. And then, yeah, honestly, within a few months, we were like quitting jobs. And
talk to me about that. Talk to me about that piece, because I think that's, for founders listening, that's the bit that's the scariest. what point did you decide and how did you decide that?
Like, I knew from the minute Akhil said the idea to me, I was like, this is something I could actually jump into and work on for decades. Like, I grew up next to the sea and like was just like adored being on the beach growing up, and just like my mum would just put me in my wetsuit, put like a bit of sun factor 50 on me and just like lash me down to the beach in like Garrettstown in West Cork. And like, I would just like spend all day like just, yeah, fucking around, building sandcastles and going and exploring rock pools, jumping off cliffs, bodyboarding, surfing, whatever, you know, like jumping off the pier, crap, you know, everything. Like, just, I loved, like, absolutely adored the ocean, loved the ocean, still do. I live, like, in Sea Point, so I get to swim, you know, as much as I can in the mornings and even, you know, the evenings and winter and summer. So, like, I've always loved the ocean. And And then, like, another thing that, like, made me, like, very, this kind of, like, idea really, like, I, you know, it's something I knew I'd love is, my, like, hero growing up was Steve Irwin, the crocodile guy from Australia. I still remember the day he died, in, like, primary school. Like, it was very, very sad. I tried to convince my teachers to have a vigil, they wouldn't. And I remember just, like, moping. I remember hearing on the radio on the way in, moping about school that day, just like annoyed that nobody else was sad that he died. I for the longest time I wanted to be a vet as well. I literally only changed that about a month out from my leaving cert to do something that would set me up for like entrepreneurship. Like, my dad's an entrepreneur, both my granddads are entrepreneurs, many of my uncles are as well. Like, it's just like my mum, I think, could see that I was like that type of brain and was like, oh, yeah. I was like, would you think of doing something maybe more that doesn't box you off as much? And it was the right decision. But, you know, so then like this idea, I was like, okay, like Akhil, who's like one of the smartest people I've ever met and like incredible person to work with. And like, you know, my other co-founders as well, just like extremely talented people. So I knew I had like this like amazing team with this like novel idea that like nobody else was doing. And it's like in the oceans and it's like with wildlife and like biodiversity. I was like, fucking, of course, like, you know, like, of course, sign me up, you know what I mean? Like, and
the stars aligned and
like, so ways. I knew from the minute like we were having a pint and he was like, well, what do you think of this? And I was like, perfect. I was like, obviously, you know, like, had to figure things out a little bit more, but I'm pretty sure from like the minute I heard the idea, I was like, oh, I just really want this to work so I can get paid to do it. And luckily it did. You know, we quit our jobs in August, went fundraising, got a round closed really quick, Lower Carbon Capital, which were our you know, number one kind of like priority in an investor. You know, one of the top climate funds in the world, offered, yeah, you know, to lead the round. And then we had some great investors come in behind them. So Super Organism, which is the only biodiversity fund in the world. Tom and Kevin there are great. Tom has actually worked as a conservationist previously. He's worked with seagrass. It's like perfect match there. You know, Lower Carbon, great match as well, because, you know, Ryan, who did the investment from the Lower Carbon side, pretty much like kickstarted or was one of the early people in the carbon removal movement. Like, he was set up the Stripe Climate team. So great to have him on board, and the wider Lower Carbon team are all just fantastic. And then we had Regen Ventures come in, an Australian fund. Yeah, I still remember like my first call with them. We knew it was just like a complete vibe fit from day one. I think Dan, the founder of that fund, had been out surfing in a seagrass meadow that morning and had like some seagrass and was showing it to us. I was like, okay, this guy gets it. And also their fund thesis is just like a perfect match for them, and they've got great people on their team, like Rose Mercerio, the CEO of Patagonia, former CEO of Patagonia on the Regen team, and others as well.
Were you extremely strategic? Because they all sound like perfect alignments. Were you extremely strategic about the fundraise?
Yeah, well, we it was a heavily oversubscribed round. We had, you know, multiples more than we could have. We needed a fundraise, wanting to come in. So we did have the pick of people at the end. Yeah, that was great to be able to like pick.
Had your target amount in mind?
We raised $2 million. So that's the amount we set out to raise from the beginning. But we could have probably raised more. We had much more demand than we could cater to. But yeah, we opted for those three for kind of very strategic reasons, and really, really happy with the partners we've taken on there.
They're incredible people to get on board straight away. Mm-hmm. Like, and we talked a lot in our previous chats about signals and the importance of alignment. Like, you seem to be extremely strategic in how you approach things, but you've moved incredibly fast. How have you married those two?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive, to be honest. I don't think, like, strategy is, like, requires, like, you know, like, hours and weeks planning things out, you know. I think, you know, it just means, like, picking a plan, going for it, and then being able to change quickly. Yeah, I'm not sure. I think we just move fast in the AI. That's like our own internal cadence. We work hard. We don't waste time on things that don't matter. We like to have like narrow focus. Also, it's great having four co-founders because it just means that like there's just more people there to shoulder the burden. There's like more hands on deck and like varied perspectives as well. So that's helpful. So.
How did you get in touch with some of these people? Because that's quite
my co-founders.
The people that invest in your company. Because you know some of them are a little bit hard to reach, aren't they?
Yeah, and I didn't have like a good like we didn't really have good like investor networks really before starting the fundraise. So we knew we wanted lower carbon, and we were like
Just explain to people who's behind that, because I think that's very relevant as well.
Yeah, Chris Sacca founded Lower Carbon Capital. Chris Sacca. His first fund, Lowercase, is probably the best performing venture capital fund of all time. They led investments, multiple investments into, you know, I think Twitter, WhatsApp, Instagram, Skype, Twilio. So like all, like pretty much every like big tech company that popped off between like, you know, 2011 and like 2016 or 17, they had like led early investments into. And then I think after about two funds of Lowercase, Chris, Crystal and Clay decided to pivot into climate, recognizing it's the most important problem in the world. They were like, we want to invest in climate startups now. And yeah, they've like extremely successful climate fund now with billions under management, and so you know that was like priority there. We had others on mind, but you know, lower carbon were definitely like near the top of the list. And you know, I was asking friends, like, does anyone know anyone who could get me an intro there? Nobody really. And then one guy who had been at an event about a year ago with the guy who just moved to a job at Lower Carbon was like, oh yeah, I think I know a guy who knows a guy. So he was like, he like sent a LinkedIn message, and then we had like an email for like, you know, like leads@lowercarbon.com or whatever, which was like just like a general.
Yeah. So not even a warm intro, you just had a cold.
Yeah. And then we just emailed them our deck and memo, didn't get any reply. And then I think we got like one reply from like an email, but, you know, I had a few questions. We replied straight away. Didn't hear anything again for another week or two. And then we were like, okay, fuck it. Like, let's just like put time in their diary. So we just did that. We just like put like an, like, you know, like 40, 30 minutes, 45 minutes in their diary. We're like, what time is like lunchtime in the US? We did that. And,
so you literally send them a Cal invite.
Yeah. And then like, nobody accepted it. And then, we were like sitting on the call, me and Akhil were like, fuck's sake, is anyone gonna turn up? And then like, they jump on a call. We have like an unbelievable conversation with
him. Someone just logs on.
Yeah.
And what did he say?
He loved that we just like put the meeting in the diary. He was like, this is, he like loved, like respected that hustle. And also he said he believed that there was like, he'd read our deck and memo. He believed there was a serious gap in the market, thought we were the team to do it. And a few minutes into the first call, he expressed an intent to lead the round. So it was quite surreal.
I love that story because it's a perfect example of the grit and the resilience and just the creativity to be an entrepreneur, of just like, because it was the perfect fit for them, right? But because of luck or alignment or so-and-so's in the office or so-and-so's not in today, it just didn't get moved through. And just by taking another route, you essentially define the success of your startup. Obviously, I think you guys would have found a way anyway, but it's just so interesting when you hear stories like that of just little persistence goes a long way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think just like, I think people don't do enough like call out Ben, to be honest. I think like I've gotten like, I've like lived in like weird places of the world from cold outbound. I've gotten very interesting jobs from like cold outbound. I think
when you say cold outbound, what do you mean?
Just like sending people like messages, letters, texts, like emails, like just like you know, without having context, so it's cold, and you're just like sending stuff. You know, just like I think you. People, most people are generally surprised when they ask for something. More often than not, you actually, you'll get it.
There's a style involved, though. You have to have style. I think you have to do creativity, things like you, because people are swamped with a lot of crap.
Yeah, you have to
break. There's a style.
Yeah, you have to break through, like, the kind of third wall a little bit. You have to stand out. But I do actually think, like, volume is, like, probably more, like... Like, yeah, getting the reps in, getting good at it, knowing, yeah, how people think, being thoughtful about it. But I just think generally, like, people know when you're being genuine or when you're being serious, you know?
Thoughtful. I think you nailed it there. Be thoughtful and be a little bit insightful. What other cold outbound have you done that have led to something interesting?
The first, like, big result I got from one was... I'd read Dennis O'Brien's book, and he, you know, the Irish billionaire, telecoms billionaire, and he got his first job from Tony Ryan, founder of Ryanair, by writing him a letter and asking him to be his PA. So I did that. I wrote him a letter and asked him to be his
PA. You wrote Dennis O'Brien a letter?
Yeah. So
what'd you say in the letter?
Basically, I read your book, you know, think what you've done is, you know, very, very admirable. You know, would like to be an entrepreneur myself. I'd love to learn from you. Here's my, like, CV.
What age are you?
Like, 19, I'd say, 20. Yeah, 19, I think. You know, gave my details. And
where did you write it to? Like, Dennis O'Brien, O'Brien HQ, Dublin?
I found out through a family friend where his office was. And sent it to that address.
Handwritten letter.
Handwrote the letter.
Posted.
And posted it, yeah. And then, like, you know, 3 days later, unknown number, get a phone call. I'm, like, in the library studying for exams in college. And I like, come out and, like, take the call. And it's like, oh, Mr. O'Brien. I was like, yeah, who's this? And he's like, oh, this is Dennis. So I was like, oh, Jesus.
No, 3 days later.
Yeah. Yeah, that week. He's like, would you like to go to the Caribbean this summer for an internship? I can't give you like an intern, like a PA job, but I can give you like an intern role for the summer. So yeah, like about a month or two later, I was flying to the Cayman Islands to work there for a summer, which was good crack.
This is one of the wildest stories I've ever heard. We've done 360 or 70 episodes. This is one of the wildest stories I've ever heard.
Yeah, it was good crack. Went out to Jamaica for like 2 weeks beforehand for training.
So he rings you. Not only does like, do you get it? Dennis O'Brien rings you. Do you want to go to the Caribbean?
Yeah.
For the summer.
Yeah, it was actually funny because I'm Will O'Brien, not related to him, but like I go in on the first day and they all thought I was like his son or something.
This lad rocking up for a summer in the Caribbean.
Yeah, they were all like very sound to me. And I was
Didn't tell them I wasn't.
Yeah. I told them once they asked, I told them I wasn't. But it was like hilarious. Like the first like day, they were just like super
Mr. O'Brien. Mr. O'Brien, yes, sir. Just let the fear hang there.
Yeah, that's wild.
So you rocked up in the Caribbean for the summer. And what were you doing?
Yeah, it was good fun. I was just like you know, swimming a lot, scuba diving. The diving there is incredible. Like crystal clear waters, like incredible, incredibly abundant, like marine life. Did a lot of that. And just like a lot of reading as well. I was living by myself over there. It was like one of my like first times probably, living alone. So I was like living outside, just like was doing like a lot of reading. Great time.
I can imagine. Mm-hmm. That's probably pretty much an understatement. So like you're living, you're 20, you're in Caribbean, living the dream.
Yeah.
I love that story because it's just a perfect example of like just being a bit creative.
Yeah.
Being a, just like, just thinking beyond the norm. Mm. Just don't be afraid to just, like, I love it. It's just, it's the perfect entrepreneur story.
And then the other one was, the other time I got like something from just like sending an email was, I during like college, maybe I was 20 or 21 at this point, I was got very interested in Buddhism. And
just, what were you studying in college, by the way? Just to
I did economics and finance in UCD.
Okay, cool.
And I specialized in maths in that degree. Did like a minor in maths, but I was very interested in like spirituality and like Eastern. At the time, I was very interested in Eastern spirituality. Obviously, raised Catholic, it's very very different to the kind of way we were raised. And I was very interested. I was reading a lot about it, and then I heard a guy on a podcast say that he had like lived with like Buddhist monks, and I was like, "Oh my god, that would be so sick! I feel like that would be like the best way to like learn about this would be like actually go there and live with them." So I was like, "How do I do that?" And basically, I just like did like an English teaching course because I read online that's how you can like teach over there, or you can live with them.
Where did you want to go?
I wanted to go to Nepal to live with Buddhist monks, or like somewhere in Southeast Asia or Asia where I could live with Buddhist monks. And I figured out that if you like basically teach English, you can get put, you know, free bed and board in return for teaching them English. So I did a TEFL like teach English course, and just started emailing monasteries. They have websites, surprisingly.
You literally read my notes. I was like, where? Or like, how do you even get there?
Well, a lot of their donors would be like US or European based. So they do need to have like an online presence.
Right.
And they do need teachers. So they do like, you can find ones. So I found one. It was based in this place called Nayapadi.
You just Googled it?
Yeah. And found one. I mean, I emailed a lot of them, but like one of them replied to me, and they're like,
"What did you say?"
I would like to teach English if you'd let me stay with you this summer.
Right. Okay. Fair enough.
I found a place, and they were just like, great. Like, rock up these dates. We'll have someone pick you up from the airport." So I flew into Kathmandu. I really like my hiking, so I did Everest Base Camp actually when I arrived, and
of course you did.
And then did my teaching stint for 3 months, and I was like spending that much money, and I was like broke college student, so I was like, I'm going halfway across the world, I'm gonna get like value for money out of these flights. Just like lived with them then for about 2.5 months.
Describe like a week to me. Like, what were you doing there?
It depends on the week. I mean, like, if it's like sometimes there's like festivals and stuff, so they would be like in prayer maybe just like for a week, and you just would have nothing, you know, you wouldn't be doing anything because they're just in prayer in the temple.
So you were living with them in the monastery or the town, so you, or how does that work?
Yeah, monastery. I was in the monastery. So you walk in, you're walking through the town, and then you walk down one of the side streets in this village, and it's a big walled monastery. You go in, and there's like a big temple in the middle, and there's like living quarters in and around the edges, and then there's like a small junior school for like the junior monks.
Okay.
There was one lama, one monk there in particular who was only like 7 years of age, but he was the reincarnation of the previous like elder high monk in that one. So it was very
seven.
Yeah, so it was very interesting. You'd see him like walking around and with everyone have such reverence to him. You know, he's only about 7 years of age. Because he is, they believe, the reincarnation of the last, maybe if you were to put in an Irish, the last bishop or something like that, equivalent.
What age did they go into the monastery?
A lot of them start quite young. I mean, you have to remember as well, you know, Nepal, these places, like a lot of people, incredibly devout country, very high levels of like spirituality and belief. It's mainly, you know, Buddhist country. But some of them, you know, it's just like coming from poor families, and it's just easier to put your child into a monastery to feed them as well. So they can start from very young. A child can leave at any point if they'd like. In fact, some of the kids that I taught there have since left. You know, connected with a few of them on like Instagram and Facebook and stuff. So I've been able to follow them. So it's interesting. You can opt out.
Why are they learning English?
Pardon?
Why are they learning English?
So they learn English, they learn Tibetan, they learn Chinese, and they learn Nepali for different reasons. But I mean, learning English just to converse with the outside world, to the Western world. As I mentioned, like a lot of the donors, like a lot of these monasteries would have good connections with Europe and the US. So they would come over maybe for a few weeks at a time and actually live in like a monastery in Europe or US. But they get to choose which one they focus on. I mean, you might just want to focus on Tibetan because it enhances your ability to study, you know, the texts, and you go to Tibet and actually study there. And Chinese for kind of other reasons as well would be important. The time there was, depended on the week, but typically you'd be doing like, you know, one or two classes a day. I was teaching kids probably ages like from kind of like 10 to 14, and yeah, just like teaching them through games mainly, you know, making it fun, making it exciting, like, or like doing like a play like the Three Little Piggies or something like that, and like doing art class and then teaching them like through art. And then just playing a lot of soccer with them as well. They love like playing soccer, and so I was like out in the yard playing with them like every day, and then yeah, like just like sitting down with them as well, and just like, you know, a few of the older guys would have had good English, just asking them questions about what they believed in, just questions I had for my own like reading that I wanted answers on, and similarly they'd ask me like questions about like Western life as well. So it was a really like nice like mutual kind of relationship there. And
what was that experience like for you then? Because obviously you had questions going over there. Did you find answers?
Yeah, I did. I mean, the biggest thing that I was questioning when I was going over there was that, like, you know, the Buddhists have a believing that desire leads to suffering. You know, when you desire for something, you create a contract that says, I'm going to be unhappy until I have that thing. So it's like, I'm thirsty now, but like, I'm not going to be happy until I have like a drink from that or something like that. And you know, they believe that these things kind of build up over time. You know, you want the next promotion, you want the next job, you want blah, blah, blah. And that's what leads to like suffering at its core. And that, like, you know, to achieve nirvana, enlightenment, you know, you need to like just like quell all desire from your life, and you know, and then that's it, that's the unlock. But you know, like coming from like Western world, like American dream, that's like so conflicting. And I was like, how the hell, like, if I just wanted for nothing, like what would I do? Like, I'd just be chilling on my couch, you know, like playing PlayStation, like, you know, like if I, you know, like, I just couldn't understand how you could live a life without like desire, like wanting for something. So I kind of like went forward and back with them on this point a lot and had some good conversations. And ultimately, I didn't get to like their point of view. And I'm not a Buddhist. I'm Christian now, actually. But like, I was asking them about this point a lot, and I kind of came to a nice like middle ground where, basically, I came to middle ground where probably the best way to describe it is like, have you ever, are you familiar with like how you keep like a rose bush? So basically if you let like a rose bush grow, without like trimming back its, stems, it becomes kind of like briars, right? Like, cause the energy gets like rerouted to the thorns or whatever. So what you want to do is you want to actually just like cut off the errant stems, and you want to get the energy to be redirected towards the flower. And that's how you get like beautiful rose bushes. It takes a bit of care. You have to trim it back. That's kind of similarly how I would think about desire, in that like there's like five things that I care about now, and like, you know, nothing, if something is bothering me, you know, if it's not one of those five things, I just ignore it. It's like my family, my friends, my health, my wealth, my craft, you know, the thing I do every day. That's helpful framework then to go about, like, if you're just like Sunday night or whatever, you're facing into the work week, you're like, oh, you know, like you're just like, and you're like, okay, well, which of these things actually that I'm worried about are actually the things that are important to me?
I like that. So you have a framework for living.
It's like one of the like few that I have, but yeah, that was forged over like a few conversations with those guys. And then just, yeah, like I did a lot of like kind of like silent like retreat type things while over there, because they were doing that anyway. And like fasted, like meditation. So
how did you find both those?
Yeah, very good. Yeah. One of them was particularly insightful. It was like 3 day long silent meditation, silent retreat, and no food for 3 days as well. Which was good. And it was like 8 hours a day. I just like whenever you'd hear like a bell go, that was like time to meditate. And they'd all go to the temple, but I wouldn't go into the temple because I mean, I wasn't a Buddhist, so I wouldn't. And as well, it's just monks who go in.
So you would meditate
in my room, yeah,
for an hour,
2 hour blocks. Okay. And yeah, I did like 4 of them every day for 3 days. Yeah, so 8 hours. Yeah, and yeah, that was good. There was some questions I'd been pondering. I mean, I wasn't taking your typical approach to meditation, where you just like quell every kind of thing from your mind. Sometimes I did that during those 3 days, but other times it just gave me space to think about a few things and find that helpful too.
Has that shaped your outlook on life? Has that 3 month experience shaped?
Probably, yeah. Not in a meaningful way. I just, yeah, probably. Yeah.
Definitely seems like you've, you like to experiment and embrace different experiences, and then it helps you to form different outlooks on things. Like you definitely have a very unique way of approaching things, and it definitely seems to have shaped a lot of what you've done. So after Nepal, come back.
Yeah, I came college. Back, and then yeah, I was finished college, COVID, started working in Zip Mobility. I was the first hire in that startup, like Irish scooter sharing company. Did that for like 3 years.
What brought you to that?
Again, just like I had pinged Charlie, the founder of Zip, when I was in college, being like, "Oh, I think what you're doing is class. We'd love to meet for a coffee." Did some intros to him. I like knew basically the right people in the council for him to speak to in Dublin City Council. So I was like, "You should probably speak to these guys." And I set up some like meetings for him or whatever, and then a few months later he was like, "Oh, I've just raised a seed round. I'd like to make like first hires. Would you like to join?" And I was like, "Ah, nothing for the summer." So we went in there for the summer, and as I joined, the UK market had just deregulated scooter sharing, basically, which was like they had kind of overnight just said, okay, starting from 1 month's time, every single local authority in the country can start an e-scooter scheme, because COVID means you can't use buses and trains. So we want to do like outdoor travel. And
okay.
So you had this like Wild West moment in this market. And we were like, it was like me, Charlie at the time, and then Ben as well. And we were just based out of like Charlie's parents' like pub in the Gleasons in Booterstown. Obviously, like the hotel part of that was like empty because it was COVID, so we were just like sleeping there and like working there, and hired like some interns who were brilliant, and we just like myself and the two lads plus like a you know a team of about 3 interns just like spent the summer bidding for e-scooter licenses in the UK, which was gas because like you know we had no experience. We had an e-scooter supplier, we had like an app, and we had like an opinion on how we believe like the best e-scooter sharing schemes should be run, particularly in the UK and Ireland. And then like basically it was kind of like taking that like operating model, and I was in charge of basically writing these proposals and like overseeing all the go to market there.
And what were you bidding to do? Like to run it or to supply it or
operate
what?
Operate an e-scooter scheme. So like come into a city, bring all the scooters, hire a local team, run a service for, you know, £1 to unlock 15p per minute or whatever.
Right.
And operate that on behalf of the local government. And basically I think we did about like 30 submissions that summer to different local governments. We won a license to operate in 7 different towns. But it was class because like it was just like me and like the lads and like our interns and up against like Bird, which was like the quickest company to ever like reach unicorn status in like less than a year or something crazy like that.
This was back when scooters were going mental. Oh, scooters going were everywhere. You couldn't, every second story was like, scooters. I never understood it. I never could square the circle to understand how it was all going to work. We'll get to that in a minute. So you started bidding, started winning.
Yeah.
How do you roll that out?
Buy a shit ton of scooters from China and get them shipped to the UK and go and live in a dingy gaff somewhere in one of the cities we're launching in for like 2 months. Yeah, like hats off to like Ben, Charlie and the rest of the team who like literally spent like a very bleak autumn in 2020 living in like five of us cramped into like one house.
So it's literally boots on the ground, get it going. Get
boots on the ground, hire a local team, get a warehouse, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I was more focused on the go-to-market, so I then started like looking at Europe, you know, once we'd kind of done that like big business development push in the UK. But yeah, buy scooters, get set up, go from there.
And logistically, are scooters not a nightmare in terms of like the wear and tear, the charging, the getting them back to the place, getting lost, getting stolen?
Yeah, they're all solvable problems, and you can avoid a lot of them just with like buying good scooters. But yeah, like there's definitely like some models of scooter are better than others. Early days of the industry, the lifetimes of the scooters, like basically the asset lifetime was just not enough to pay back the purchase price. So you had a lot of those problems, and you still do. So I think, look, ultimately, I think micromobility is needed. You need last mile transport options. You know, you can't get a Lewis stop to everyone's door. You can, you know, really, really increase the amount of people you're enabling to get on the Lewis or on the bus or on the metro by adding these like solutions. And the technology is improving consistently, but you know, it was like a ZERP, you know, zero interest rate phenomenon, where basically you just fucking make interest rates zero and like, okay, this is like a feasible business model. Let's just go raise money and do it everywhere in the world. There were just too many people doing it.
Yeah.
Right. Like that, like, you know, Peter Thiel called competition is for losers. I saw like firsthand there when you compare it to that industry and like how difficult it was to compare like what we're doing now, where, you know, there's like less people, you know, in our space. And it's just like night and day, the difference, you know, like
Everything's a lesson if you're willing to learn, right? Every single lesson you got, cause sometimes people just do the same thing over and over. They stick in micromobility for their life because they're like, I just know it, I know it's going to come good someday. Whereas you're now, I love that quote, competition's for losers.
Yeah,
Peter Thiel has just so many gems. Like it probably definitely has influenced your thought process with business, has it?
That experience,
just Zip and everything you've done, oh, so far, 100%. Like has it shaped how you even thought about what next business you might start?
Oh yeah, absolutely. That was like an incredibly good ability to like space to learn. I mean, like I think like first hire is like the best place you can learn startup without being a founder. I mean, you know, you don't have as much of, like, you know, there's a lot of pressure on Charlie and he you know, like, you handled it amazingly well, and he was a brilliant founder and led us and was a great leader for our company, and I got to see all of that firsthand without being the founder. So it was like it's a really unique position to be, and I learned a lot from Charlie. Charlie's a great founder and taught me lots, and well, I learned a lot from that experience. I learned a lot from the other people I worked with, like Ben and Ali and others that I worked with, so Lorcan. So yeah, definitely learned a lot from that experience.
Talking about Eric.
Yeah,
this is catching fire.
It's a community of people that are dedicated to advancing material progress in Ireland. Basically just like advancing forward Ireland, accelerating us into the future, I suppose, and keeping that trend going. It was born out of a place of myself and friends being very dissatisfied with the path we saw Ireland on. I mean, like, both kind of culturally speaking, like, you know, you had this real tall poppy syndrome in Ireland where, you know, anyone sticks their head above the parapet, it gets knocked down. You know, people propose things for Ireland and the reaction is like, but sure, we could never do that. Like, and it's like, you're never going to do it with an opinion like that, with a mindset like that. And yeah, we just wanted to create like a space and a community for Irish people to be, you know, more ambitious and embrace the same concepts that brought us to where we are, which is a very unique place in the world. And, you know, it was embracing technology that brought us here. It was embracing economic growth. It was being ambitious, taking after people like TK Whitaker, who really brought us into the 21st century, and asking now, like, what do we need to do to bring us into the 22nd century? And it's pretty much just a community online. You can find us on Twitter at ERAAC. Basically it's just like creating a container for people to meet like-minded individuals, potential collaborators for projects, to like materialize this in a more meaningful way.
There's so much negativity in the world. I think, especially in Ireland, if there's ever a time we need stuff like this where people can go, I'm just going to check out of all that negativity, because it's just, it's all encompassing in the minute. Especially for young entrepreneurs coming up, like, it can be often a bit confusing. Where do I go? Where do I even start to meet these other great people? Like, because you need to seek it out, right? It's not going to come knocking on your door. You need to find communities like this and just have those conversations like you had going seagrass, huh? That's where incredible things can start. So we'll do a quick fire round now in a minute, but bring me kind of like over the next kind of, because you're moving at an incredible rate, the next 12 to 24 months, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, building like fully autonomous robots that restore seagrass ecosystems is what we're doing. So there's all aspects of that. You need to collect seeds, you need to plant seeds, you need to monitor their growth thereafter. And we're just going to have technology that does all of that. We plan to have like our first fully autonomous systems done this year and have them tested in the field, at the kind of kilometer restoration scale. Getting them up and running at the moment, and the guys are doing like incredible work on the dev side for that. Commercially speaking as well, branching out into more areas, into more like geographies, and doing restoration in more places, building that out, building out the team as well. We're a pretty light team at the moment, and we'll be growing pretty sharply over the next 12 months. But yeah, just putting like all the work in place now, and that is required to create like the number one company in the world for ocean ecosystem restoration. And rewilding the ocean is our mission. So whatever we need to do in the next year to do that, to bring more biodiversity back to our oceans, to restore ocean health, to start drawing down more carbon, anything that we need to do under that mission, getting it done.
And where do you see yourself working? Will you guys be traveling around? I know you've clients all over the world, but this is a global issue, I'd imagine.
Yeah, every ocean, seagrass is in every ocean on Earth. We plan to go beyond just seagrass as well. In recent months, our team have been to the Middle East, to Asia, to Australia, to the US, Europe. More of that.
And where do you see yourself based long term?
I think, personally, I want to live in Ireland when I'm older. I love this country. I think one of the challenges we're facing at the moment is the lack of like hardware talent here. So it's likely that we will be building out a base in the US, San Francisco, because there's such high density of like hardware engineers out there. Between over and back over the ocean for the next while anyway. Long term, hope to be back here.
Do a quick fire round. What book do you think every entrepreneur should read?
I think probably like just probably like some. I'm generally weary of the business book category. I think a lot of it's fluff, kind of like once you've read one of them, you know all of it. It's kind of like
this book should have been a blog post. The blog post should have been a Twitter thread.
Yeah, and it's kind of similar to like it can be a bit self-helpy in some ways, which I also have my gripes with. You know, if self-help really worked, would you not just like need to read one book, you know, and not like a whole category? But in terms of like entrepreneurs and what books to read, I think like definitely Zero to One by Peter Thiel. If you're like interested in starting a business, if you're managing people, High Output Management by Andy Grove is up there as well. And then just like I think a book I think everyone should read is Denial of Death by Ernest Becker, who's wrote in the set written in the 70 won the Pulitzer Prize in 1974. It's basically a book about what motivates every human, and it's a theory on basically human motivation, but also like why society is structured the way it is. So I mean, his like, you know, core thesis is that humans have this like so Ernest Becker was a psychotherapist, a philosopher, who was then diagnosed with terminal cancer, and he wrote this book on his deathbed, and it was his last release, and it won a Pulitzer Prize. But basically, it's he believes that the core motivating factor behind any human is a fear of death, that we're afraid of dying, and it's very baked into us. And because we, you know, we're the first animals to actually have, you know, be conscious and realize our own death, it creates this very unique positioning ourselves, and therefore we seek to beat death and to be immortal. And you know, humans live in one of two worlds. We live in the material world, you know, atoms and bits, and this world that we can touch and feel, but we also live in this like symbolic world, which is the world of ideas and symbols and story, and the only world in which you can actually be immortal in is actually in the symbolic world. So you know, his thesis is that we are always looking for immortality, and we're looking for symbolic immortality. And that is like, you can get that like in like one of two ways. You can, you know, so he's got this theory of cosmic heroism, but basically that like become like immortal yourself in a symbolic way, in the same way that, you know, maybe a Napoleon or like a Jesus or a Joan of Arc character has achieved like some level of like symbolic immortality, or you become a part of one of their movements and one of their, you become a part of their story, and that's, you know you become a follower of Christianity, or you become say, so, you know, you work for one of these people, and that's how you like get, you know, retain onto your sense of immortality. Really, really interesting book. It's dense, but it's like I think if you're like it's very refreshingly unique in inside. It was very pivotal. It's kind of laid the foundations for this interesting field called terror management theory. I don't hear people talking about it as much as I think.
No, it's definitely a new recommendation, so thank you so much. That's brilliant, and thanks for the explanation. That sounds really interesting. Hopefully, you're listening to the pod and you're feeling inspired. Maybe you want to do new things in your own business, or maybe you have that brilliant idea you've always wanted to bring a little bit further and see if it works. So why not right now? You listen to the majority of the guests in this show, and they've been helped by the local enterprise office at some stage in the journey. They have something for everybody. Whether you have that idea you want to develop, you want to get your products to new markets, you want to innovate your existing products, or you want to expand staff and premises, they have the supports to help. So why not today? If you want to start up or grow your business, then contact your local enterprise office today. What's something you'd learn the hard way?
Yeah, I suppose just like things don't always work out the way you plan them to.
What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
I don't think of it in that sense. I don't think I've sacrificed anything. I'm living the life that I want to live. I'm doing a good job, I think, at balancing, you know, the multiple aspects of my life. Luckily, I don't think I've had to sacrifice too much, and sacrifice, I don't, maybe trade-off is things I've definitely make trade-offs, but none of it that I'm not content with.
Appreciate the honesty. What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
Probably give my mum some money so she could get a B&B down in West Cork. So I just want to do that. My dad has like a social enterprise called See My Skills, which supports people with disabilities to find meaningful employment. So give him some money for that and a party or something. And probably give some to my siblings and extended family. And then given the fact that I'm pretty broke, maybe like look after myself a little bit and what I have left. Just I think it would be so fun to be able to support people with like, you know, visions of the future that, you know, I vibe with and I want to see like come to fruition and that I believe that they can actually do it. You know, that could be like startup founders, but it also just like creatives. I think like in an underappreciated way, particularly in technology, culture can be like extremely influential on the future. And that like, you know, in the same way that like, you know, like that Ernest Becker book, you know, this two worlds, symbolic world and material world, like, you know, the material world influences the symbolic world, but also vice versa as well. And I think like, you know, if you want to create like a beautiful future, you need like art that like inspires people. You need like, you know, journalists and or like researchers who are like coming up with the ideas for this like future world that you want to live in. And yeah, God, if I had some money, there's some people there I'd love to support. Or even like in Ireland, like, you know, we've like a nonprofit that I've been involved with for the last few years called 18 for Zero. They're working on basically like nuclear energy and getting it legalized here. It's banned here. And, you know, I'd love to be able to financially support what they're doing because the climate problem is at its core, you know, one big part of it is an energy problem as well and solving that and decarbonizing energy. And yeah, I'm just such a big fan of their work and would love to be able to support groups like that in like a more meaningful way.
What's something in your daily routine you wish you started sooner?
I'm going to be controversial here and because I think you'll appreciate it. Well, I actually think routine is overrated. I think daily routines are overrated. I don't do anything daily except sleep. It's the only thing I probably do consistently daily. Some days I don't drink water. Some days, you know, I don't eat. Like the only thing I consistently do every day is like sleep. And I've always been like reasonably good at getting enough of that. But I think humans, I can see why you would enforce discipline. And I think discipline is a very valuable trait. And I think, yes, there's definitely things I wish I did more of and maybe a routine would help me with that. But like, you know, I don't think like, I think it's very good to live like your life in tune with like intuition. And I think that's underrated. I think like being like intuitive and, you know, knowing how to like, you know, if, you know, this day you like feel like, okay, I should probably rest today. Or like, I find this, like, I like to like live my life in tune a bit with the seasons. Whereas like winter, it's like more rest focused. Spring is like more like higher energy. Summer is like full hilt, go, go, go. And then awesome, you're starting to rest again. I think just like that's the way we would have adapted. I don't think a hunter-gatherer would have had like a morning routine, you know, 7 o'clock, defend tribe from, you know, Siberian tiger, you know, like it's like, you know, like it's like I think being adaptive is underrated. Being, and you know, that, you know, it require a bit of discipline to do that because maybe if you don't have like a daily routine, then you end up doing things. So there's not much that I kind of wish I did every day because I think there's nothing I think I should do every day. Well, there's a few things, but there's definitely things I wish I did more of. Like I wish maybe I did a bit more exercise or ate better, swam the sea more, rang my parents more, prayed more, you know, like,
I like your seasons point. I like that idea. So I've only started thinking about that recently the last couple of years of how much the seasons do impact humans.
Yeah, but we're animals.
We use like things like electric light and things to try trick ourselves, but it doesn't really make sense. Like, no. You know, like the darkness in the winter does impact you and you have to like work around it. You can't get up at 4 a.m. in the middle of November because you're just going to be dragging yourself out.
Move with it. Yeah,
I'm going to give you 1 million euro. You can invest in one person, one company. Who?
Probably Danielle Fong. She's the founder of Lightcell. They've developed this new thing called a Lightcell, which is basically a new way of generating electricity. So basically you take salt, you take sodium salt, you take a fuel source and you ignite that, you create heat, you add the salt to the heat source, and you get to, have you ever seen when they like light sodium on fire? Have you ever seen like salts dropped into fire? The different salts give off different wavelengths. Sodium salt gives off a very bright kind of like orange yellowy light, and basically you have this like controlled reaction around it, and then around this light cell you have a series of solar panels that are finely tuned to that wavelength band, and it's really, really efficient basically at converting the chemical energy stored in the salt to light energy and then that into electricity. So what this basically enables us, what light cells enable us to do, is it can be scaled up to be as small as a water bottle, or it could be as big as a V8 engine. And basically you have a silent, very low emission, very efficient way of now generating electricity. So, the light cell, really can replace things like internal combustion engines. It can replace diesel generators. It can be used in all sorts of areas of the world. And I think like it could really like be interesting and upend the energy economy and change the way we think about energy, because it's just so easy to transport. You're transporting a light cell with a fuel source, and notoriously difficult thing to do. Electricity, one of the reasons it's difficult for us to scale up renewables is because the grid problems, pretty much.
Yeah.
So I think I was in her warehouse recently in San Francisco. She's like a incredibly interesting person, went to college like age 12, finished at 17, PhD dropout, Princeton, all this kind of stuff. Like,
it kind of makes more sense now when you explain that. Yeah.
Super genius, yeah. Like incredible inventor, has been thinking about this problem for like a long time, has worked on like a similar kind of a problem previously, very motivated by it, and has had very like strong, promising initial success. And it's something I want to see in the world as well. As I was saying before, like climate is something I care a lot about, and at the core of it, there's an energy problem there that needs to be solved. I have a lot of other people I'd love to give money to, but I met Danielle recently, and I think what she's doing is great.
Sounds incredible. It's always very difficult asking early founders this question, because you've just started. But if you just start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
Yeah, I think what you said there is, I don't want to do anything else, right? So not many. I mean, one idea that I think is very interesting that I've been reading about recently, and maybe we'll end up doing this through Ulysses or not, but there's this concept called ocean iron fertilization, which is another approach for marine carbon dioxide removal, carbon removal through the oceans. Basically, it's so as I was describing, like the ocean is a massive carbon sink. So one way of removing that is through planting seagrass and other forms of aquatic plant. But another part of the carbon cycle in the ocean is phytoplankton. The plankton that, take in light, take in carbon, and they die and then they fall to the bottom of the ocean, right? That's another like way of removing carbon in the ocean. Basically, the limiting factor on phytoplankton populations in a load of different places around the world is iron content. There was and there's a very good quote from a scientist working on this in the 80s, and he said, "Give me half a tanker of iron and I will give you an ice age." Basically, like, alluding to the point that there is like incredible ability to remove carbon by stimulating phytoplankton growth in different parts of the ocean. So the idea is that you would sprinkle iron filings onto the ocean. This already happens every summer when the Sahara winds blow iron off the desert, You get phytoplankton blooms off the coast of Africa.
Oh.
It's a natural process, but you're basically just accentuating it. And what it's really, really good for is, as I mentioned, the phytoplankton growth removes carbon from the atmosphere and then they die and fall to the bottom. But also it's really, really good for biodiversity. So it stimulates like the increase of fish populations. So there was an experiment done off the coast of Canada about a decade ago, and had really, really positive impacts on local salmon populations. They had the biggest catch they'd had in years. So it's really, really good for local biodiversity. There's a lot of questions around it. There's a lot of science that needs to be done still around like the monitoring, reporting and verification of it. But it's like, as I said, I love the oceans. I love the idea of working on climate. I love like helping biodiversity in some way. So it's a very similar business to what we're doing now. And maybe we will just grow to do that within our current umbrella.
Okay.
I don't know, but I think someone should do it. Nobody's doing it, I don't think.
I've got an easy question for you. What do you believe other people find strange or strongly disagree with?
Have like a few here, probably.
Rattle off a couple of quick fires for me.
I think ideas are more important than execution. I think people say execution is like, you know, ideas are easy, blah, blah, blah. Like, nah, disagree. Sorry. I think ideas are more important. I think, okay, if I said to you tomorrow, start a $1 billion company for me, right? Overnight, you could write out the project plan to raise the money you could plan like how would you approach your first hires. You could maybe draw like a process map for how you would come up with an idea. You could do all the execution stuff really well. In fact, you could ask ChatGPT to do it for you, or you could hire McKinsey. But coming up with that genius idea, you can't force that, right? Like, and so like the supply of good ideas is it's very difficult to come up with good ideas. I think a lot of people get this wrong. I think like, you know, at the core of a good startup is like one really good founding idea, and then like a kind of maelstrom of like good ideas built on top of that. So a good founding idea plus really good technical ideas built on top of that. But the execution part, I mean, yeah, you can hire McKinsey in to do like the execution part. Like, you know, you can do the execution part. It's like good ideas are underrated. It's like, it's very difficult to come up with good ideas, I think. And you can just tell, it's hard to describe how what a good idea even is. But I think it's like, it's kind of like taste. I think like, you know, like Rick Rubin is like the best, I think, at this. In a music sense, at least, like he just has good taste. And I think like, you know, similarly, I think people should like look to cultivate taste when it comes to good ideas, and expose them to it. Try to expose themselves to it a lot. So I think that one, I think that you know, that's one for sure. I think, yeah, ideas are underrated. I think rationality is probably overrated. I think if I ask you to name like, you know, what are your like 10 favorite things, like I guarantee you like 9 out of 10 of them are just not rational, you know, like they're like, but they're your favorite things, you love doing them, but you can't explain why you love doing them, but you still love doing them, right? So like, but I think we've been kind of like led into believing that like, you know, the perfect life is, you know, entirely rational or whatever. And it's like, no, it's not. Like, I mean, like, and like all of these like genius ideas that people have come up with that once were irrational, completely irrational, didn't make sense. Or these things that people did, you know, didn't make sense at one point. So, yeah, I think we've been kind of... And you can take this to its limits then. I think this kind of like also shows the kind of limitations in like the scientific method. I think there's limitations there. I could talk for a while about that. I won't. But yeah.
Second last question. What's one thing you spend money on that brings you happiness?
Food.
In particular, what food though, Will?
Cooking myself at home. Like I cooked a dinner for myself on Saturday night there. And it was just like probably the best burger I've ever had in my entire life.
I saw this on your Twitter. Yeah. By the way, go follow Will on, I'm going to still call it Twitter forever, but you rank sausage rolls.
I also love sausage rolls. Yes. I have.
And you have a ranking.
I have a ranking system in my Apple Notes app. I love
sausage. Rationality's overrated.
Rolls. Exactly. I just fucking love sausage rolls, right?
Like, this guy's going to save the planet. But he loves sausage rolls.
Yeah, I love. Yeah, like went. I just like. Yeah, I love good meat. I love like a good steak. I love, steak tartare, oysters. So like, yeah, I just spend lots of money on eating out and that kind of thing. And it's like, the average person today can eat better food than any king in antiquity. And I feel like people don't take advantage of it enough. That's why I like hate when I see people drinking like fucking like Soylent or something, like you know, these like meal raisin. Well, I'm like. Like, you could drink anything and you're, like, on this diet where you just drink, like, Soylent all the time. Like, you can literally go down the street there and have like the nicest meal ever. I'm like, I get it from health perspectives, these things make sense or whatever. But yeah, I think that's why I also, as I already said, I don't believe maybe in like rigid structure, like routines. Similarly with diets, don't believe in them. I think
intuitive.
Yeah, be intuitive. Yeah.
What's your final piece of advice for every entrepreneur or aspiring entrepreneur listening?
I don't have any advice. I don't feel like I'm in a position to give advice. I think actually we have an oversupply of advice in the world and an undersupply in conviction. And people like believing, like, I think everyone has it all here up already, right? Like there's nothing I'm going to tell anyone now that's going to help them like solve the problems. They probably already know it. They just need to do it, you know, or not do it. And that's completely fine. But like, nobody just sitting on a podcast saying something is going to unlock a new part of their brain. Like, a lot of the good things have been said already. They're written down in books somewhere, or they've heard them before. And yeah, I don't have any advice.
Stop not talking, anyway. Start doing.
Or don't do. And that's fine too. But like, don't try to solve everything. Like, not everything can be solved with like a soundbite or a piece of advice or something like that. And that's fine too. I think people just need to be more intuitive and in touch with themselves and like what their own brain is saying to them and things. Because sometimes if you can't do something, maybe it's because it's not the right thing for you. And that's fine. But find out what you can do or you should do and do it. But yeah. Sorry, I don't have any advice, but
often that's definitely the first time we've had it, and it's nice and refreshing.
Yeah,
I think people have got a lot of advice off you in the last hour and 18 minutes anyway.
Nice.
Will, where can we point people to learn more about you or give you a follow?
Yeah, probably just like Twitter, at Will O'Bry. Yeah, at Will O'Bry. And yeah, there you'll find links to Ulysses, and you can check out the great work that we're doing there. Yeah, you can get in touch.
Will, that was an absolutely fascinating chat. Thank you so much.
Good. Yeah, thanks for having me on, Gary.